Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, are you enlightened? Oh, yeah? How do you know? Or if not, how do you know? Well, maybe we need to find out more about what this means. Well, maybe you are enlightened. Let's hope so. But to know better, we're going to talk to the author of a book called Enlightenment Now, Liberation is Your True Nature. And it's really helpful to know more about this so that we can maybe believe in ourselves a little bit more. So we're going to be talking with the author of Enlightenment Now, Jason Gregory. Jason, welcome to Energy Stew.
Oh, it's great to be on, Peter. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad to talk with you. You're in Chiang Mai, right?
Yeah, I'm in Chiang Mai, yeah.
I love Chiang Mai. I was there in 1974.
Wow, that's a long time. Changed a lot since 1974, I can tell you.
I know. My brother was living there then, so I was there visiting him. Anyway, we could talk a lot about Chiang Mai, but let's talk about enlightenment. I love your book. It really helps because you do get to the point. And that's really, you know, so many people are very confused about this whole path, the whole spirituality path, actually. What is spirituality? And where, what is it bringing us to? Is it really bringing us to enlightenment? And what is enlightenment? And your book really handles that.
Well, I think a lot of our, we could say, cultural perceptions actually confuse the matter a little bit, I think, because especially when we look at it from a Western perspective, usually we're in the mode of thinking or striving to attain goals and you know, to achieve certain things, and we kind of superimpose that onto things like enlightenment, which, you know, the term enlightenment, especially the way I use it in the book, is from the Eastern perspective. So it's kind of the state of consciousness that we would, the liberated state of consciousness that we would associate with enlightenment. So, you know, when, especially in the West, when we became familiar with a lot more Eastern philosophy and spirituality in the, you know, the 60s and the 70s, a lot of people started to think that enlightenment itself was something we attain, you know, off in the future,
yeah,
and so forth.
Yeah, it's a method. A method. And if we can only use the method properly by finding the right spiritual teacher, and, you know, and work hard enough at it, you know, maybe we'll be enlightened. Let's get into some Zen Buddhist practice and be very rigid about it, and maybe that will help us escape.
Yeah. Well, this is what we thought back then, Peter, you know, and that's what we still think now, a lot of people. But the nature, especially of Eastern thought, is very, it's peculiar, and it's a lot different than Western thought. So, you know, a lot of Eastern thought is built on nonlinear thinking and stepping outside of the constraints of time. And so enlightenment itself is actually thought of as a state of consciousness where we come back into the present moment, which is outside the experience of time. And you know, from the Eastern perspective, this is kind of the eternal sphere as well, because in the present moment, when you're in thinking and time cut out, that's kind of the experience of eternity. But, you know, to experience that state, we can't be wound up with our thoughts and the idea of who we think we are.
Yeah, you can't even have a mind. I don't understand that whole approach, because it's like denial. It's like, if I can deny my mind enough, maybe I'll get a glimpse of eternity. And, you know, how long can that happen for before your mind says, oh, we're here again?
That's it. Well, again, it's a flux too, Peter. It's not something that a lot of people think that, if they do negate their mind like that, that they will be like that forever. And that's not quite the case, you know, to use a Zen proverb, you know, before enlightenment, chopping wood, carrying water, after enlightenment, chopping wood, carrying water. You know, life still goes on. You still do have thoughts and you still do have your persona, But the difference is that you've kind of recognized that there's a deeper aspect about yourself. It's not kind of that you just disappear. A lot of people make those wrong assumptions. You know, some people might read the Bhagavad Gita, for example, and they might think that liberation and enlightenment is in the complete negation of your persona system. And it is somewhat to an extent, but again, it's like, to use Joseph Campbell's analogy, you have to sort of come back from the hero's journey, you could say. So you have to sort of come back from that experience of being outside of yourself and to integrate back with the world as well. So, you know, understanding enlightenment is not so black and white, you know, to the way that we usually think. So,
yeah, I think that there is something we're trying to attain. And I think it's just greater, in a sense, greater self-knowledge of the journey that we're on to see ourselves in the larger context of the universe.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, to see yourself in the larger context of the universe, you know, you have to, there is things that you have to do, you have to work on your character, you know what I mean? If you're not quite a humble person, it's probably virtuous to cultivate humility and just certain traits like this, which are aspects of sacrifice and surrender to something greater than yourself. Because when you realize you are part of something much greater than just your personal interests and your own personal ego, you know, then you have no problem to surrender certain aspects of yourself for the greater good, and also for greater understanding and greater knowledge. Well, so
I think what you're talking about is the impulse of evolution, and that's driven by, you know, truth, beauty, and goodness. So we're always striving to see ourselves, or at least hope to see ourselves, in that light. And you know, that's an innate evolutionary sense, I think, of being on this journey. In the whole universe, which is striving forward, I believe anyway, and so I think this desire for enlightenment is part of that desire for truth and beauty and goodness, I guess. But we also need to understand the real concept of our egos and our minds and how limiting they can be in bumping us along on this journey.
Well, definitely. And that can also, you know, the ego itself can also eclipse even the evolutionary aspect,
sure,
as well.
And
you know, I know
his,
that
on his head. And we're having that right now in the world.
Well, we only have to have a look outside the window, don't we? But it's kind of you know, especially when we look at it from the Eastern perspective, there's a ton of paradoxes, even with what you just said, Peter. Like, you know, we have all of these desires for attainment and this and that is driven evolutionary, you know, by the cosmos, because our mind is a process of that. But at the same time, when we develop too many, you could say, what would we say, like systems or frameworks within our mind, that also keeps us away from that cosmic river or the Tao, as they would say in China, in Chinese.
And
so,
some of that are the teachings.
Yeah.
You know, because there are different kinds of teachings, and some have to do with duality and some have to do with non-duality and passivity, and some have to do with action. So it's really about how you want to understand presence and work with believe in something.
Well, it was beautiful what you said. Like, if you look at two different frameworks in the East, like if you look at classical yoga, which was created by Patanjali, that in itself is a dualistic philosophy, dualistic metaphysics, as opposed to Vedanta, which was earlier than that in India, which is Advaita Vedanta, the Advaita aspect of Vedanta. Advaita means non-duality, which is obviously non-dual metaphysics or non-dual philosophy. But when you get down to the crux of both philosophies, kind of the end, you know, the goal or the means of the philosophy is basically the same, to get to that state of consciousness, which is not wound up and not bound by, you know, cultural conditioning or social conditioning, that which is kind of liberated from, you know, from all of these limitations that we impose on ourselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, you see that in the Yoga Sutras where with the phrase Chitta Vritti Nirodha, which is the cessation of the whirlpools of mind, which doesn't mean that you cease the whirlpools of mind forever, but it means that you have cultivated that ability to kind of step outside of yourself, especially in moments of emotional charge where, you know, a lot of people react emotionally, and often cases the reactions are not well thought out. So there's a whole, especially in East, a lot of people discount that there's a lot of strategies within Eastern philosophy that we can apply even to our modern day psychology and society. So
right, yeah, because we're trying to attain, and let's call it the beauty aspect of mind, of being in that centered state of awareness, that we can feel peace and feel wholeness and oneness. And it's a beautiful state to be in. And yet, you know, it's not what true enlightenment is about, because true enlightenment encompasses everything, not just these moments of, you know, of stillness.
No, of course not. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I like what you said. And again, like to be in that presence or that state of enlightenment more often, beginning with that sort of, you know, I guess stillness practices and so forth and so on are a kind of a way of trying to cultivate that more of that clear perception that we have of reality or having the insight into reality. But you know, it's, again, this is another paradox in the East. It's kind of like the idea of trying not to try, or how do I become natural again, or how do I become enlightened or recognize my enlightenment without trying to do it, without using any effort, because that's what a lot of sages are asking us to do. So
yeah, well,
there's a lot of paradoxes
there.
The
other point, but what about the other side of sages that ask us the opposite? For instance, you know, the old, I don't see images of it anymore, of a yogi lying on a bed of nails. you know, it's the idea that we have to actually embrace the suffering, become one with it, and see ourselves on the journey in truly in life, which is, as Buddha said, is suffering, to see ourselves in that and embrace it, to be able to see beyond it, in terms of that the journey speaks for itself.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And there is, again, this is why there was even schools in India where you would go and you would, if you were a disciple, you would stay with a master for, they would recommend 12 years, you know, so for 12 years
yeah,
you would.
And they'd make you suffer during the time.
Yeah, yeah, well, this is it. They would suffer for their so-called enlightenment. So they would, in some sense, they would continually be in the process of practicing meditation every day, attending satsang with the teacher and receiving darshan.
Yeah, but the teacher often would make their lives miserable. Like Milarepa went through that, where, incredible
pain.
Yeah,
this is what I was getting to, because like even back in those times when that was happening, some disciples were, you know, were bursting with joy after 1 year or 1 week or 2 weeks, and a lot of the other disciples would kind of throw water on their fire and say, you know, it's too early, it can't be like this, you know. So, and it was too much of a, you could say, like a regimented system. Whereas, you know, enlightenment itself or ananda bliss doesn't sort of ascribe to a time frame, you know, that it's just these are experiences that we have that, you know, we don't, you know, especially if we look at all the literature, there is no specific time of when a certain thing should happen, you know. But in a lot of mystery schools, they have these tendencies. You know, you see this in Freemasonry. You see it still in India with a lot of schools of thought. But it's hard to calculate with a certain time frame on those certain things.
Yeah, and that's why, for instance, I was friendly with a a Rinpoche, Kalu Rinpoche, who was in isolation in retreat for 26 years. And he was really a very blissful man. I loved being in his presence. And it was like, you know, it's that you get to that place where it is what it is. We are who we are. And surrender, and we can find joy in the journey, no matter what, because we're aware, because we're alive, because we have awareness, we have consciousness, and our consciousness can't be harmed, because that's really what exists. And I think the ultimate is to understand that's, you know, just our. It's a universal awareness, but it's just our aliveness, our awakeness, is the bottom line. Outside of that, it's all just patterns of ego and mind and society and culture and bodies and you name it.
Well, that's why I use in enlightenment now. I use Purusha, the Sanskrit Purusha, as the. This is a phrase they use in classical yoga. It's kind of similar to Atman in Vedanta, which is kind of a state of awareness or perception. What they would say, you know, in India is a transcendental self. This is very, very similar to Tathata in Mahayana Buddhism, which is the experience of suchness or thusness. And this is that that sort of like what you were saying, that experience of, you know, perceiving reality as it is beyond the patterns of thought, of, you know, even the patterns of the physical world, these continual whirlpools. And I use Prakriti as the opposite, you could say, in a sense, to Purusha, because in classical yoga, Prakriti is referring to all of the motion. Whether that be mental energy or the material world of the whole universe, but Purusha is kind of in a sense beneath that. And when you kind of come in back in contact with that, like what you said, that universal awareness, you could call that, then you can perceive reality, you know, in its naked state, beyond definitions of this and that. You know, we right. see this is prevalent within, not only within Indian thought, but it's also prevalent within Taoism in China, where you have the stepping beyond
the isness.
In the Zhuangzi text, the classical Taoist sage Zhuangzi, you know, he kind of says, you know, when there is no more this and that, you see the infinite in all things. So he's kind of alluding to this universal awareness or perception that we can, you know, that we actually innately have, but we've kind of caked over the top of it with our, you know, with our own cultural perceptions, social perceptions, and the development of our ego as well.
Right. So it's nice to see that. But then let's take it to the next level, the Brahman level, which Michael Talbot talks about in the Holographic Universe, which is understanding that our consciousness is how reality is seen. We can't reality doesn't exist if we aren't conscious. And so
we're the creation of reality. And in the East, there's a beautiful phrase, Peter. It's the universe produces consciousness, but consciousness provokes the universe. And this is kind of
exactly.
this inherent.
I love that.
This is that inherent paradox, and like what Michael Talbot was saying, like without consciousness, in a sense, there is no universe. That's why, you know, in that phrase that I said, the East are trying to not say it's kind of one sided, but trying to, you know, not to cancel out either side. So, saying that there is this inherent mutuality in the cosmos, in existence, but it's not really mutual, you know. It's kind of a unified mutuality. This is why in Vedanta, you know, the Atman, so the undifferentiated consciousness or the non-dual state of perception at the base of our being, is actually Brahman is the universal matrix, is all that exists. So it's identical with that. We have that within us, but you know, it's difficult, especially in a world that's as complex as ours, is to continually identify with that and to be marinated right. in that. So that's why they say in India, they say you need to find your own Parabrahman, and that means your own supreme Brahman, meaning within yourself. So and you know,
so, but it comes from the comfort of knowing the awareness state.
Yeah.
And you know, and then you can create from that. Now let's talk about where we're headed, because I've been doing some shows with Carl Kalaman talking about the ninth wave of consciousness that seems to be coming in. And I spoke to an astronomer recently that our solar system has risen above the stream of our galaxy, so that it's in a direct alignment with the center of the galaxy now, receiving very, very powerful vibes from that central source. And this is astronomical. This is, you know, NASA understands this. And so this all means that we are coming into a state where maybe more and more and more people will reach this presence. And I think that's what people strive for more than anything, is not so much to be intellectual as just to be more present and aware in a higher state that reduces fear, reduces the struggle, just because we know better. And you talk about in the book with Valerie Hunt's work and the cycles per second of our brain, and the higher that can go, the better off we can be, right?
Exactly, yeah. Well, without presence and awareness, it doesn't matter how intellectual you are, you know, because without presence and awareness, there is no intellectual sphere. There is no, you know, at the base of our being is presence and awareness. And you know, if the science is right and more people are waking up and more people are becoming more present and aware and becoming more mindful in everyday life of not just themselves but of everything else in the world and, you know, in the universe, then, you know, that's a beautiful thing. But we can see this also one and two ways. If we look at, I like to go back to the George Ivanovich Gurdjieff's work, and he had an interesting perspective of this, because he always thought that to take care of the organic world, we kind of need how can I put this? We need kind of people who are not totally conscious to keep the organic human ecosystem moving and evolving. But there will always be, his view was that people waking up and becoming enlightened and becoming more consciously aware was kind of against nature's rhythm. Now we don't have to believe Gurdjieff's idea.
He also took advantage of it.
His idea was that you don't really, once you become enlightened, you kind of don't, you're not kind of an active contributor no more to the organic unfoldment. So you've kind of woke up and you've reached, you've understood the Brahman, the you know, the universal essence, and it doesn't mean your life doesn't go on, but you've kind of, because you're marinated in that awareness, that you've lost your, not lost your ability, but you've kind of haven't, you know, there's no need for you to engage too much in worldly activity anymore. So this is why he was sort of saying that, you know, people who are engaged in worldly activity move the human civilization along, but they themselves will not become enlightened. So he, you know, he kind of related this to, you know, certain souls that would come back and so forth and so on. So there's a lot of, you know, I know that science is out there with particular alignments and so forth and so on, but I don't think it's so cut and dry to make a categorical distinction that we are, that more people are going to continue to wake up, because there was a lot of this talk around 2012 as well, Peter, as you surely know.
Well, I think there's been this talk for eons.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
and I think that, I think that there's a lot of psychological aspects towards this too, because we always want to believe that, you know, we are going to have peace on earth and everyone's going to be enlightened and so forth and so on. And then in some sense, you know, there's a lot of, like, some teachers, for example, that I've been with in India and so forth and so on, have always said, you know, that's good in theory, but, you know, the human drama is still a beautiful thing if you learn to see it a certain way.
So, yeah, I'm here for the growth of working through this, you know, the suffering to enlighten, you know, to bring the light of love to our souls through hardship. It really opens our hearts to work hard to free ourselves. And I think that's a great purpose in life, is the heart purpose of meaning and purpose in society with each other and for ourselves.
Yeah.
So we don't want to lose so much of that, but does it have to be so hard?
Well, I think that that's what we're sort of getting at, isn't it? Like, it doesn't have to be that hard, and there doesn't have to be a lot of, you know, agendas driven by certain ideologies as well, you know, and certain leaders, you know, not accepting other countries and accepting other religions and cultures. You know, it doesn't have to be this way, but, you know, I guess in a sense, it is this way. So at the moment, so, you know, we have to deal with it in a certain sense.
Right. But we're getting near the end of the show.
Yeah.
And I think the way people can deal with it best is by reading your book.
Well, that's great if they did. And they would realize that, you know, actually, you know, in the story of the Buddha, even though the Buddha taught that all life is suffering, you know, one of his main tenets is that we don't necessarily have to suffer. We only suffer because we have over-identified with the belief of our identity. So,
right.
You know, we don't have to.
We're moving beyond our limited beliefs and understand it. And there's so much in your book, but I want to move people in that direction, Enlightenment Now. And you're Jason Gregory. Is there a website that people can go to?
Yeah, you can find my website. It's Jason Gregory, just my name, .org.
Uh-huh.
And my Twitter is Jason Gregory 33. And yeah.
That's great. Jason, thanks so much. I love talking with you. This is so much fun. Maybe we can talk again.
I enjoyed it, Peter. It was a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. And this is Peter Ross, host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.